It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's like an earthquake. When we encounter a person who, because of the enormity and depth of his or her vision, passion, and very presence, it can change our world. And so it was with Yosef Hayin Yerushalmi. In an oral history for the Yiddish Book Center, Dorothy Goldstone explained she is now an author of historical fiction on Jewish topics. And why? She says, because I got to take a course on modern Jewish history, which I didn't think existed, being taught by a guy named Yerushalmi. And Yerushalmi is, until he passed away, but he still is, one of the greatest professors on Jewish history, modern Jewish history, who ever existed. And I didn't know that. I just took this course, and I just exploded with excitement, like, I don't know, fireworks going off in my brain. I thought Jewish history was one story. So Moses went up the hill. He got 3 tablets. He got so angry and dropped them. They broke. He went back up the hill. He got shortchanged and only came down with 2. Because every year in Hebrew school, that's as far as we got in the story. We never got any farther. That's the story we got told over and over again. We don't exist. Not true, as we all know. And he was, Yerushalmi, teaching me about our history. Oh, God, I was so excited. And he just changed my path. And from then, I just gobbled up that stuff. It was very exciting because he was teaching me in 1969, right in the middle of the revolutions happening around the world, the student revolutions. But we were learning about the equivalent revolutions that happened in Russia, led by Jewish intellectuals. And it was pretty cool. Dorothy Goldstone, in conversation with Bina Addis for the Wexler Oral History Project of the Yiddish Book Center in October 2012. Professor Yerushalmi had that effect on his students, and some of them, like Dorothy Goldstone, went on to write stories, fictional stories, and others, like David Myers, became historians themselves, who went on to explore the questions and challenges they first experienced in Professor Yerushalmi's classes, and in doing so have not only carried on their mentor's work, but developed their own body of work that will have a lasting impact on their field of study and beyond. Because, as we'll soon learn, the way Professor Yerushalmi approached history can be applied more broadly to the ways we as humans make sense of our world at a fundamental level. David Myers holds the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Chair in Jewish History at UCLA. He previously served as chair of the UCLA History Department and as director of the UCLA Center for Jewish Studies. He received his bachelor's degree from Yale College in 1982 and undertook graduate studies at Tel Aviv and Harvard universities before completing his doctorate at Columbia in 1991. He has written extensively in the fields of modern Jewish intellectual and cultural history. At UCLA, he teaches courses on Jewish history and the history of history. And he is a native of Scranton, the son of Sondra and Maury Myers. And he is a regular presenter at the Schemmel Forum at the University of Scranton. During a recent visit to the Schemmel Forum, Dr. Myers paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about his recent study, Jewish History, a very short introduction, part of the Oxford University series, Very Short Introductions. And we began by talking about his early days and formative years here in northeastern Pennsylvania.
My parents' home was a kind of salon. They would have friends and acquaintances and newly acquired friends come to their home from really all around the country, but particularly from New York. And as a young kid growing up in Scranton, I was exposed to artists, intellectuals, writers here in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And there was a kind of dissonance, I should say, between the kids' environment in which I grew up, the society of young people, and that salon. I don't think of Scranton as an intellectual center of tremendous heft in and of its own right, but my parents' home was, and You know, as I came to know more about Scranton, I also came to discover that it has its own pockets of intellectual, artistic, and cultural creativity that are quite considerable. So I very much remember that.
Were you a young writer? Were you obviously a young reader?
I was both. I was a reader, and I was also someone who, as you know, a young fourth or fifth grader, really developed a passion for writing. And that was something which my parents indeed cultivated, and so did my teachers, I have to say. They really recognized that this was not only something for which I had a passion, but something for which I had some measure of aptitude. And they encouraged me. And that was, you know, that in fourth grade in particular, I remember being recognized as someone who has a particular ability and being given special attention and pulled out of class. And I very much, you know, cherish and appreciate to this day those teachers who in a certain sense, took a chance on me. I have to say one other thing, though, about my parents and growing up. At one level, their home was this kind of oasis of cultural activity and really a quite remarkable intellectual venue in its own way. But probably the criterion of greatest significance for them that they tried to impart to me was to be a doer. They were very much committed to the idea of thought in action, not just thinking and not just writing and not just creating, but doing. So I would say doing.
In terms of understanding and loving history, at what point did that take fire?
I think I was always interested in, before I had an articulated interest in history, I was interested in story. I was interested in the infinite variety of stories that one heard or could tell. I was interested, and I think appreciated from a very early stage in life, I was interested in the idea that everybody's story is interesting. And to this day, I hold to that belief. Part of that has to do with my father's tendency to interview or interrogate people who come to our home, come to my parents' home, really plumbing the depths of detail. He's a lawyer, and it's important for him as a lawyer to get the details of a particular story. But there's also a real appreciation and love for the richness of detail in the telling of story. And I think, on one hand, I love to write and construct a narrative that had a coherent beginning, middle, and end. And on the other end of the spectrum, I really loved the richness of the detail of storytelling. And that, I think, really preceded my interest in history writ large. That came, in a way, when I was an early teenager.
What about being part of the Jewish community in Scranton?
A very important part of my experience. I think of Scranton as the last remaining medieval kehillah, or autonomous community, where there was such a rich sense of collective ethnic identity. Scranton, in my childhood, was a highly ethnicized place. Everybody had an ethnic marker. So-and-so was Italian, so-and-so was Irish, so-and-so was Jewish, so-and-so was African-American. Everybody had an ethnic, or in some cases, racial marker. And Scranton, for a city of its size, had an exceptionally rich Jewish institutional life. And those Jewish institutions were my home away from home. The synagogue and the Jewish Community Center, these were the places where I really grew up. And I left Scranton with a very pronounced sense of communal identity that I would say is very hard to replicate. I live in major cities in New York and Los Angeles, and one doesn't find that same holistic integrity of community that one sees in Scranton. On the other hand, I have to say, there were some deficits to communal life here. I mean, you knew everybody, so it could get a little stale. And it wasn't, it wasn't the most intellectually exciting place Jewishly. That I found elsewhere. I should say one other important thing about my Jewish formation. My parents took my brother and me to Israel on the occasion of his bar mitzvah when I was 11 years old. And my parents and grandparents had been very involved in the Jewish community and efforts to support the fledgling state of Israel. And that experience at age 11 inserted in me something. I often think of it as the sensory effect that I remember most profoundly was the taste of tahina. was a taste of food. I, to this day, remain a huge lover of hummus and tahina. That's what I remember, that kind of exotic allure. And something about that drew me to that place hypnotically. And I returned when I was 14 and 16 and 18, 19, and actually began my graduate training in Jewish history at Tel Aviv University. And that was another very important thread in the fabric of my my Jewish identity. It's become over the years a complicated tale because Israel is an exceptionally complicated place, but that was certainly an important piece.
What you've just laid out for us so briefly would give us a sense of how you might be able to do something like this, an entire history in a very short volume. You left Scranton to go to...
I left Scranton to go to Yale College, where I did my undergraduate degree, and from there I moved to Israel in 1982 with the intention of immigrating to Israel. So deep was my passion for the place. It was not a good year to immigrate to Israel. It was the year of the first Lebanon War, which was an extraordinarily contentious and fractious moment in Israeli history, one that had a very profound effect on me. But nonetheless, I did study Jewish history in a master's program for 2 years at Tel Aviv University, and then came back to the United States to do a year in graduate school at Harvard before making my way to Columbia University, where I received my PhD and where I found my great teacher.
You dedicate this book to this teacher. Tell us about what was so extraordinary.
My teacher was the towering Jewish historian of his generation. His name was Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, a very Hebrew name for a guy born in the Bronx, but born to a family in which Hebrew and Yiddish were as fluent from the mouths of all participants as was English. So he grew up in a trilingual setting, and he possessed a degree of erudition that no one of our generation could possibly command. As I describe it, my encounter with Yerushalmi, Erica, was life-altering. Life-altering. As I tend to think of it, before him, I saw Jewish history, which I had studied at Harvard and Tel Aviv, in black and white. And after Yerushalmi, I saw Jewish history in the most explosive polychromatic terms. It was an absolutely earth-shattering encounter that I shudder when I think of to this day. And this is 1985. This is 33 years ago that I first met Professor Yerushalmi. He also elevated Jewish history from a kind of parochial pursuit into the most enlightened cosmopolitan undertaking you could imagine. In other words, this became, in a certain sense, the coolest thing you could possibly study. And when you think of the great canon of modern Jewish creators, right, let's begin Mahler, Freud, Einstein, Kafka, and one could go on and on, you get a sense of what Yerushalmi was drawing from. And he transmitted to his students a sense of both the nobility, the cosmopolitan nature, and the urgency of the task of studying Jewish history. And one other very important thing that he imparted. Many great historians are expert in one milieu or one century. Yerushalmi was both exceptionally proficient in specific milieu and possessed of a sweeping view of the entirety of Jewish history. And he imparted to his students a belief in the importance of being familiar with every corner of the Jewish world, with every period of Jewish history. The great German Jewish thinker Franz Rosenzweig, at an early stage in his life, when he began to make his way towards more traditional observance from his highly assimilated upbringing, announced the goal that nothing Jewish should be foreign to him. Yerushalmi introduced to us the principle that nothing Jewish historical should be foreign to us. So when I was asked to write a book summing up the entirety of Jewish history, and I should add, as the Oxford series demands, in 35,000 words, I felt this was the appropriate homage to my teacher, Professor Yerushalmi.
And I think one of the fascinating things, and it may go back to your wonderful roots of hearing the stories, you keep washing in contemporary things. So all along, we see the thrust of what might have been ancient and how it resonates today,
right.
Because it does just what right. it sounds like he did for all
well,
of you.
Well, that's right. I mean, he layered accretion upon accretion of Jewish cultural history, each one adding to the richness of that texture, that mosaic. And certainly a good part of me wants to try to replicate that layering of accretion upon accretion. What I knew when I embarked upon the task of writing this history of a 4,000-year-old people in 100 short pages was that a mere chronological account wouldn't work. That wouldn't get at the richness of the subject. And I eschewed that idea very early on. I decided, and we often say we're going to do it, but I decided that the only way to go about this would be to approach it thematically by selecting a number of key themes, which are themselves terrifyingly limited. I could add another 10 major themes to the book, but I limited it to 5. And in each, I tried to add those layers of accretion to see what the connective tissue of Jewish history was. Because one of the questions that I set out to answer is, how has this small, often powerless, dispersed people actually survived, and not only survived, but thrived through so many historical periods and in the face of so many profound challenges? And part of the answer lies in the development of an adaptive mechanism that allowed Jews to encounter new situations, new host societies, draw upon the riches of those host societies, and yet transform what they drew from the host society into a kind of distinctly Jewish idiom. And a very good representation of this process is the series of Jewish languages that emerged from the time of Aramaic, which was Jesus's language, whereby Jews were in a new host society, not themselves politically sovereign, learned the language of the land, operated in the marketplace in that language, but then rendered that language oftentimes in Hebrew characters, adding Hebrew words and some other loan words from additional languages in the surrounding environs, and created their own, in a certain sense, parallel language to the vernacular of the realm, which they also commanded. And that, in a certain sense, that process, I think, reflects perfectly both the drawing, the extending of tentacles into the host society, and then the drawing back to create this Jewish variant of a particular linguistic form. It's a brilliant practice and exercise, and it helps us explain how Jews were able to navigate between residing somewhat comfortably, somewhat we can talk about further, in a host society, and preserving enough group particularism in order to maintain a distinct identity. Jews have managed that balancing act in ways that very few peoples have throughout the course of history. Many greater and more powerful peoples have come and exited the stage of history. The Jews remain, and I think that adaptive capacity, that, in a certain ironic sense, that process triggered by assimilation, assimilating into the culture of the host society, has been a very curious preservative force, curious and effective preservative force. We often think today that, and certainly in Jewish communal discourse, that assimilation is a grave danger, right? Assimilation is what leads Jews to the point of disappearance. Assimilation in its fullest form entails an eradication of any trace of particularism. One thing I try to show in this book is counterintuitively, ironically, assimilation was necessary to Jewish survival. In the absence of it, Jews would have been a fossil. Millennia ago, they would have been ossified. But it was that constant exposure to new cultures that, in a certain sense, honed the cultural muscle of the Jews. It required them to flex and tone up. And that is one of the two unlikely causes for Jewish survival that I posit in this book. The other is even more surprising.
The irony of the dialectic there of the anti-Semitism.
Right. So I make this, on the face of it, startling claim that in addition to assimilation as one of the keys to Jewish survival, anti-Semitism was as well. And what do I mean by that? I mean very decidedly anti-Semitism in non-lethal doses. It's important to note because anti-Semitism in lethal doses has obviously had an extraordinarily negative and devastating effect on Jews, most particularly, but not exclusively, in the Holocaust. But my claim is that anti-Semitism served as an obstacle toward the otherwise uninhibited path of Jews toward full assimilation. Were it not for anti-Semitism, Jews would have simply absorbed and assimilated into the host society and disappeared and be largely unknown to us from history. But the persistence of anti-Semitism served, among other effects, to remind Jews of their very distinctiveness. Now, this is not an original insight. This is an insight that was perhaps made most famous by the great 17th century philosopher of Jewish origin, Benedictus Baruch Spinoza, who in the third chapter of his famous theological political treatise said, the following occurs. Jews in antiquity separated themselves by virtue of the laws and commandments that they were said to have received in revelation. That separation, owing to customary or legal norms that were different from the rest of society, not only set them apart, but brought down upon them the hostility of the Gentile because they separated themselves. And implied in that was there was a sense of superiority. And in fact, what went along with separation was indeed a sense of chosenness. And here's where Spinoza makes the additional move. The hostility of the Gentile served to reaffirm to the Jew his or her distinctiveness. The hostility of the Gentile reaffirmed to the Jew why the Jew was distinctive, why the Jew was separate. And so you have this interesting reaffirmation of the Jew's own original impulse to separate. Now, this becomes particularly important in the modern era when other conventional markers of Jewish identity that were present in antiquity and in the Middle Ages, like a firm, unbreakable faith or unquestioned adherence to Jewish ritual law or the insular boundaries of an autonomous community, were no longer present. In the modern age, in the absence of those affirmative markers of identity, Jews often discovered they were Jewish when told so by an anti-Semite. And that had the ironic effect of reinforcing the distinctive identity of Jews. Where do we hear this? Sigmund Freud tells us, I had very little sense of being a Jew until I walked on the campus of the University of Vienna and was called in derogatory fashion a Jew. It was at that point that I came to consciousness and I made my way to the local Jewish self-defense organization and affiliated in that sense. That was, by the way, a very common response of Jews who had few other affirmative markers of identity to draw on other than anti-Semitism. They made their way into organizations devoted to combating anti-Semitism, and that became a chief way of manifesting their Jewishness. We see this in American society today. There are many organizations, B'nai B'rith, Anti-Defamation League, American Jewish Committee, that arose as defense organizations against anti-Semitism. And it should be noted, as organizations very much devoted to the principle that Jews can and should integrate into their host societies, and that anti-Semitism was antithetical to that process.
What's intriguing to me about the first theme, the assimilation and that back and forth with different cultures, that sounds an awful lot like the principles of complexity theory in the new biological sciences, where environments come together at the edges and there's that interaction and there's tension perhaps, but the interaction at the edges does just what you suggested would have happened and strengthens the muscle and makes something new.
I mean, we've often vexed before we had the benefit of 21st century cognitive science. We had the benefit of recognizing, scholars of modern Jewish history, the liminal status of Jews, the liminality, that position on the border, perched between cultural traditions. Kafka gives wonderful expression to this when he said, I often felt like a horse whose legs were stuck in the past and whose forelegs were seeking to find their place in a new world. You have the sense of sort of seeking a position in a new world, but not being fully able to do so. Jews were in certainly Europe in modern society, but not fully of it. They had a constant stigma of otherness that attended them. And we tend to think, justifiably so, that the attendant status that they held, not being fully of, not being fully part of the society, but understanding many of the cultural cues, created a certain animating tension that brought on its own creativity, that it was precisely that liminal position that allowed Jews to absorb from the cultural riches of the host society, but not be comfortable enough in it, that produced this creative impulse and the impulse toward innovation and the impulse to upend convention and establish norm. And of course, you know, in the holy triumvirate of Marx, Freud, Einstein, one sees that impulse. And they're all very good cases because they all came from one form or another of marginal Jewish background and were held at bay by the host society because of their Jewish origins in some fashion. And they dwelt in that liminal space, being able to peer out into the host society, see what was going on, feel sufficiently detached from it to want to create something new. And in that way, it's very much, I think, at the borders that we should look for these fonts of inspiration and creativity. That's where we find it. And that's what I think has been so extraordinary about the modern Jewish historical experience. That's what my teacher, Professor Yerushalmi, saw as such a cosmopolitan pursuit, because it was, in a certain sense, cultural cosmopolitanism of the purest form. We don't really belong in any one place. We're not fully landed, right? A very fine historian from Berkeley by the name of Yuri Slezkin wrote a wonderful book called The Jewish Century, arguing that that Jewish cosmopolitanism is emblematic of modernity writ large. And he divided the world into the landed peoples, the Apollonians, and the fleet cosmopolitan travelers between cultures, the Mercurians, and argued that Jews are the Mercurians par excellence. And I think that's right. And it's very much about that border positioning.
You talk about the motion and the movement of the Jewish people. And yet you talked too just now about the landedness. And then we can't get out of a conversation like this without talking about the land.
Right. So you've referred at various points in time to the dialectics of history. And in fact, there are dialectics within Jewish history. So in direct response to that cosmopolitanism, that rootless cosmopolitanism, by the way, of which Jews were accused by their most hated rivals, but which nonetheless bears some measure of truth, that sense that we owe fealty really to the wider universe, not to a particular locale or folk or people. In response to that, and in response to the sense that that kind of fleet cosmopolitanism does not provide a cure to the malady of anti-Semitism, in the late 19th century, along came a group of Jews who said, we can no longer wait for European society to emancipate us fully, as was hoped at the end of the 18th century. We must emancipate ourselves. We must engage in a process of auto or self-emancipation. And thus was born Jewish nationalism in an era when nationalism was very much the currency of the realm. There are many varieties of Jewish nationalisms. Some varieties said we should be a cultural nation without sovereignty in the land where we currently dwell. For example, in Eastern Europe, where the world's largest population of Jews dwelt, we don't aspire to sovereignty. We aspire to cultural autonomy, the right to run our own schools, theaters, cultural institutions in our own language under the aegis of a state authority. On the other end of the spectrum of Jewish nationalism were those who said cultural autonomy in the diaspora is no cure to the Jewish question, is no cure to anti-Semitism. What we need is what any self-respecting nation seeks, which is sovereignty in its own land. Now, the complication in the story is that those who first began to advocate this idea, promote this idea, were not proximate to the land that they dreamt of. It's very often the case, almost always, that national groups that aspire to sovereignty dwell on the land that they hope will become their sovereign nation. But Jews had to go back to antiquity and draw upon their millennia of yearnings to return to the land of their forefathers and mothers' origin, the land of Israel. And thus was born the Zionist movement, which very much had the aspiration of overturning that rootlessness and that cosmopolitanism and that bookishness that the people of the book, as Jews were known, so represented. They wanted to overturn all of those things and return not just to the ancestral homeland, but to the land by which they hoped to rehabilitate themselves physically through tilling the soil. And thus was born the Zionist movement, which was, in a certain sense, to use Slezkin's terms, the Apollonian side of the equation, the landedness. And I would say that much of modern Jewish history is, in a certain sense, a pendulous swing and a dialectical move between the cosmopolitan and the landed. And, you know, that is one way to, in fact, understand the ongoing debate in the Jewish world about how we define ourselves. Do we define ourselves as a landed entity rooted in our homeland? Or do we define ourselves as a global people, which is at home and yet not fully at home in many cultures the world over? That debate, which began in the 19th century, continues to the present.
When you come here to speak at the Shemel Forum, you address issues of current day Middle East peace and tension. How does what you say with your co-presenter, what is the backdrop that this history would provide for a conversation such as that?
Right. So I have been lecturing for the last 2.5 years or so on the origins and evolution of the Israel-Palestine conflict with my friend and colleague, Dr. Hussein Ibish, based on our shared desire to understand the lived experience of Jews and Arabs in Palestine and later the State of Israel with a mix of critical distance and empathy. We think that's the right balance to strike. We believe there is a great deal of truth in the narratives that both Jews and Arabs tell about their relationship to the land. We believe that thinking in zero-sum terms, thinking that the veracity of one account is mutually exclusive of the veracity of another, is a wrong-headed way to approach this. My own sense is that, you know, I try to adopt a multivocal approach to the study of history, including Israel-Palestine. And that really draws from, I think, my sense of the multiple colors and voices and personalities of Jewish history. Jewish history doesn't lend itself to narrow, tunnel-visioned, stereotypical portrayals. It is so vibrant and explosively alive and multifarious in its cultural incarnations that it becomes a kind of method. It's not just a content. It's not just the content of Jewish. It's a kind of method to see the. It's a lens through which to see the world. And I try to use that lens, that sort of that openness to multiple ways of seeing things, which Jewish history manifests. For example, there are thousands of varieties of Jewish customs, minhagim, that we can trace the world over as Jews settled into different locales and drew upon the culture of the host society and modified it to fit their ritual norms and expectations. If we pull those customs together, those habits and norms, we have this extraordinary rich mosaic. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that's not just a piece of fabric to study. It's also an epistemology. It's also a method. It's a way to understand the world. And I try to bring that lens, that openness to multiple narratives, to the study of Israel-Palestine, where I think it's terribly important to recognize that there are multiple truths at work. There are multiple rights. And we don't yet have clarity about what you do when you have multiple rights, about how you reconcile them. But recognition of the truth lying in the story of the other, to go back to stories, is an essential first step towards humanizing the other.
And so what you suggest about the method then, it's a method for all of us to approach these situations in life and in our world.
That's what we're trying to impart. My friend Hussein Ibish shares that view. He too has a skepticism about monodimensionality, about tunnel-visioned accounts of the past. And the fact that I approach it through this multicolored and multi-leveled lens of Jewish history doesn't mean it's restricted to Jews or scholars of Jewish history. It's really a way to look at the world. It's a way to look at the world with a measure of openness and tolerance for the diversity, the explosive and rich diversity of others. One of my favorite Jewish thinkers, about whom I wrote a book, relatively unknown thinker who was on the founding faculty of Brandeis University, a great Jewish scholar by the name of Simon Ravidovich, wrote an essay in which he suggested a fifth freedom on top of the four freedoms that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, articulated in his State of the Union speech, I think in January 1941. The principle that Ravidovich articulated as a fifth freedom was what he called libertas differendi, the right to be different. And he understood the world as a world of rich differences that nonetheless created a very rich whole. He worried about the homogenizing effects of a kind of liberal neutrality, the aspiration to have everybody assimilate to the same norm, which oftentimes in, say, American society is a very white norm. And Ravidovich was, in a certain sense, a multiculturalist avant la lettre, before there was multiculturalism. And he articulated in the 1940s this principle of the richness of human diversity, the richness of cultural diversity the world over, and saw this not as a Jewish preserve, but as a great gift to the world at large. And I believe in the richness of the human experience and its infinite varieties, and believe that the challenge is to extract the unity out of that diversity.
And we take you back to where we began here in Scranton, and the way you describe the importance of story and hearing the stories here in Scranton.
Absolutely right. It begins with that infinite variety of interests that lies in everybody's story. And, you know, what I try to do as an historian is to listen to the story, because in that story lies a very substantial piece of the truth of the richness of human existence.
Dr. David Myers, originally from northeastern Pennsylvania. His parents are Sondra and Maury Myers of Scranton. Dr. Myers holds the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Chair in Jewish History at UCLA, where he teaches courses on Jewish history and the history of history. Dr. Myers paid a visit to the WVIA studios recently to talk with us about his study, Jewish History, a very short introduction, part of the Oxford University series, Very Short Introductions. Dr. Myers is a regular presenter at the Schemmel Forum, and it is very possible that he will return to the Schemmel Forum at the University of Scranton in the spring semester to carry on his conversations with Dr. Hussein Ibish about the Middle East, and that will be back by popular demand. For more information on the web, history.ucla.edu, history.ucla.edu. And the study is titled Jewish History, a Very Short Introduction, issued by Oxford University. And Myers is spelled M-Y-E-R-S, M-Y-E-R-S, Dr. David Myers. For more information on the web, history.ucla.edu.